Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Joseph Sternberg, a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. Importantly, he writes political economics. He's based in London. He can now help me with a headline that I find in Bloomberg, U.S. Bloomberg, that is a challenge, something like reading the headlines in Nature or Science magazine. I read them aloud because I don't understand them. I will read this aloud. Debt limit fight risks early end to Fed quantitative tightening. Here's a clue. Fed has penciled in shrinking its bond portfolio into 2024. Another clue. Economists see rising risk Fed will need to end its plan early. Joe, I'm sure this has to do with the price of everything. I'm sure this has got to be price stability. I'm sure that it might actually connect to the stock market. Now, a rumor mongering that the Fed will move a quarter point in February, a quarter point in March, and then quit. Rumor mongering that the Fed will raise its target from 2% inflation to 4% inflation. But I'm guessing. What is quantitative tightening that the Fed can end, and how does it mean that it's important to settle the debt limit fight, which seems partisan warfare as usual? Thank you, Joe.
Well, so quantitative tightening refers to the reversal of quantitative easing. I mean, you'll remember after the 2008 financial panic and then again during the pandemic, the Fed swelled its balance sheet by buying very large quantities of treasury bonds and also mortgage-backed securities. And so now, as part of its effort to normalize monetary policy, in addition to raising interest rates, the Fed is unwinding a lot of those purchases, potentially by, you know, allowing bonds to run off the balance sheet, not buying more bonds when the principal matures, or potentially selling bonds into the market. And I think that the problem that they run into is that then this, of course, means that there is a lot of treasury issuance that the Fed is not absorbing that the private market needs to buy. And that has implications for the sorts of interest rates that get charged on those bonds. And now this is the part of the point. I mean, this is part and parcel of the Fed's effort to try to normalize policy by allowing more market-driven and higher interest rates than we have had over the past 15 years. The difficulty is that that is apparently coming during a moment when we're going to have a series of showdowns about the debt ceiling, which is going to create a lot of market uncertainty about the, you know, stability or desirability of holding U.S. debt. And so it is just, to my mind, I think the key point is that no one understands exactly what all of these effects might mean at the end of the day, because we've never been in this situation before. The Fed's balance sheet has never been as big as it was. It has never been a participant in bond markets, and to the extent that it has been under quantitative easing, has never tried to reverse that policy via doing, you know, by doing quantitative tightening. It has never tried to do this at a time when the economy was in the state that it's in and inflation was where it is. And the Fed has also never tried to do this while there was a political argument going on over fiscal policy, and particularly the size of the national debt. So I look at this and I think, gee, wouldn't we have been better off if the Fed had started this normalization path a decade ago before all of these problems started piling up?
I want to see if I understand. Because we were in an unprecedented place before, that is, with zero interest rate for a long period of time, and then along came the black swan, the pandemic, maybe a dozen black swans, the pandemic. The Fed was then reinforced in its zero interest rate and the quantitative easing sort of flooding everybody with money, which is what happened. That was also unprecedented. And now we're recovering from two unprecedented facts, the zero interest rate and the flood of money. Joe, does that mean nobody knows where we're going?
Pretty much, because, you know, there's no roadmap for this. I think that the easing policies that the Fed undertook were highly experimental, and so that necessarily means that the exit from those policies also is going to be highly experimental. And I think that there's no roadmap for how to navigate the kind of fiscal fight that is going on, because each of the debt ceiling fights that we've had to date have had slightly different, you know, complexions based on the political alignments and sort of what was going on there and the absolute level of debt that people were dealing with. So we are in a very unprecedented situation right now. And so my default is to be skeptical of anyone who purports to speak with any sort of certainty about how it's all going to play out.
Recession, that word is routine now. It no longer frightens anybody. Stagflation gets attention, but recession, recession, recession. Except not yet. I remember us talking about this last summer, and the expectation was first quarter, second quarter, 23, but not yet. Now the question is there a recession? Because there's reporting in Europe that Europe is not in recession, that manufacturing is showing growth. So if there's no recession to be seen in Europe, does that mean there's no recession coming, or that we're just not certain when it's going to be, if we've moved it to the third quarter or the fourth quarter, or maybe 24?
Well, I think the thing that has scrambled a lot of these predictions in Europe has been the energy situation, because the concerns that there was going to be a recession in Europe were premised on the fear that we had last summer, that they were not going to have enough natural gas to continue powering the industrial economy, especially in Germany, which is the linchpin of the Eurozone economy, and that they were not going to be able to absorb radically higher energy prices the deeper into winter they got. Now, what has changed since we had those dire predictions of recession 6 months ago, the weather has turned out to be a bit milder than expected, which has had a beneficial effect on the level of gas demand. Industries have been a bit better at moderating their demand for energy without overly impinging on production. And I, you know, the prices seem to be manageable, albeit with huge subsidies from governments across Europe, the bill for which is going to have to come due eventually. So I think it's these combination of factors, which now as we start heading into February soon, is creating a certain amount of optimism that actually the crisis might have been survivable, at least for this winter. But again, I think a lot of it is still going to depend on how mild the weather is over the next couple months until we really get into spring, and what happens with energy prices, because that's going to determine the ability of European industry to keep chugging along at the rate that it has been.
There is anecdote again. I don't have any chart in front of me that Europe is not now paying the electricity prices it expected to pay because of the things that you just laid out, the climate, the storage, the planning, the working hard. Is that enough to explain why no recession, or why there's suddenly this stream of sunlight coming across a gloomy landscape because electricity is cheaper?
That might be enough, because, I mean, remember that the predictions of energy price spikes were truly catastrophic. And so it's been an enormous relief that that has not materialized yet. And then I think that the other important factor to keep in mind here is that the U.S. economy has performed better than we might have thought that it would have 6 or 7 months ago. So far, the U.S. seems to be avoiding the recession, although I think that there are somewhat gloomier signals in the U.S. Than there might be in Europe right now. And so that has, for the time being, alleviated one of the big headwinds that Europe always faces, because I think the Eurozone tends to really struggle if the U.S. economy is not performing very well. But again, I think the important thing to remember in this discussion is how contingent all of this is. And you can't really say that Europe is out of the woods yet. And you also can't really say that Europe is the master of its own fate on a lot of these issues. Because the reality is that it is not going to be economic policies that are made in Europe that are necessarily going to determine whether there's a recession here in coming months. It is going to be issues like the energy price question, which is partly a global question. Partly it's going to be about the U.S. economy, events beyond Europe's control.
What about that anecdote about raising the target for inflation from 2% to 4%? Is that the bull's dreaming, or is that something that you think is rational because of the difficulty of getting to 2 from where we are?
Well, I mean, if the argument that they were going to make is that you have to raise the target because they just can't hit the 2% target, then that really is defining deviancy down. I mean, talk about the, you know, setting a low bar there. I mean, I think the more serious argument that you often hear is that the economy had configured itself in such a way after the global financial panic that you needed a more aggressive inflation target in order to restore market's faith in central banks, the credibility of central banks, and reinforce the central bank's determination to hit their inflation goals. Now, that argument never really made a lot of sense to me if you weren't if you were below 2% inflation and it was not obvious that being below 2% was doing any damage to the economy. But okay, I mean, there's a school of thought that says the higher inflation target is good for economic growth, even if there's no evidence for that. But I mean, this would make absolutely no sense now, because the thing that is bad for the credibility of central banks is their failure to get inflation back down to the 2% target or below it. And markets are going to notice if the central bank's solution to this problem is to give themselves a new target that they also still would not be meeting right now. So, I mean, either you hit the target that you had set for yourself or you don't. I think that is the key question that determines how credible these institutions are.
I believe 9 out of 9 bankers say recession, except for there's one banker, Goldman Sachs, says no recession. Is that too fantastic, Joe? No recession? Could everybody have it wrong?
Well, I mean, look, there are so many moving parts right now that I think that it is particularly difficult to predict, what kind of business cycle we're going to have now or where it is going. Historical experience has been that you cannot unwind the kind of easy, loose monetary policy that we've had for nigh on 15 years here without creating some kind of problem in the financial system that ends up triggering a broader downturn in the Main Street economy. So the historical precedents are not good here. And this is also coming against a policy backdrop where the Biden administration and the legacy of the Democratic Congress that, you know, is just gone has been very negative for the supply side of the economy in terms of regulatory overreach, tax policy, energy policy, the rest of it. So, I mean, there are a lot of headwinds right now, and it's entirely possible that the economy might manage to overcome those anyway, particularly if energy prices manage to continue falling. But again, I mean, it's going to be a very variable sort of thing. I wouldn't feel confident predicting one way or the other.
Joseph Sternberg, member of the editorial board of The Wall Street Journal. He writes political economics. Importantly, he's in London. And we're going to London next. Life in London and some explanations needed for the banning of gas boilers and the subsidizing of people who turn off all the lights and don't use electricity. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.